This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And yes, this is The Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector, as we come to you every Friday morning at 9 o'clock. And my guest today, Adrien Besson. Adrien Besson is the editor-in-chief of News 24 and the author of a number of books on the underside of politics, shall we say, corruption and the malefactors and the people who do mean and nasty things. But he's an accomplished journalist. He's got a whole desk full of awards, including such things as the CNN African Journalist of the Year and the Taco Cooper. I've never been able to say that name properly. Taco Cooper, is that right?
Cooper.
Award, which is a significantly prestigious one as well. In a real brief rundown, he started at Beeld in 2003, which is, that's two decades ago now. Then he moved over to the Mail and Guardian and became a founding member of Amabungani, which is not a newspaper per se, but it was, the rough translation is the group of dung beetles, which dig for things and find the secrets and let us know everything. Then he moved on to City Press as assistant editor. He became editor of Beeld 10 years ago, and then he's now editor-in-chief of News 24. They include Zuma Exposed, Blessed by Bosasa. Well, that's... wow. And most recently, Who Will Rule South Africa, written together with another veteran journalist, Juanita Hunter. And if I must confess that I usually like to read the books before we talk to the authors, but this time it's out so recently, I haven't had a chance to do more than just, do a quick look at it. But the synopsis tells me that the authors track the demise of the ANC from Mandela to Ramaphosa and the rise of a new political class that will determine the next phase of South Africa's democracy. And they go right through all the current scandals right up to last week, I guess. And then they switch gears and say, what are the scenarios for a coalition government after the election next year? And what is it going to mean when people like John Steenhuisen, Julius Malema, or Herman Mashaba gain access to the union buildings? That's what your publicist tells me. And I apologize again for not having read it yet, but I will run out and I will get it and I will read it through cover to cover. And we're doing this interview, and it comes along at a very timely moment. The Harvard Growth Lab just issued a report today that says that the South African economy is performing poorly and society is facing the consequences of extreme unemployment and inequality. Three decades after the end of apartheid, the economy remains defined by stagnation and exclusion. And current strategies are not achieving inclusion and empowerment in practice. And with all those positive things in mind, Adrien, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me, Brooks. Always nice to be on your show.
Tell me how I've read lots of books by lots of people who give us scenarios for the future. And I, at one point years ago, I one of the essays for the Dino King scenarios gave us a variety of courses, middle, upper, lower, and disastrous. And people like Clem Sumter have over the years carved out a niche, doing that. And there are Franz Cronier has done it. And now you've weighed in, the two of you, with a book on a very similar topic. So the question obviously is what metrics are you using to judge governmental failure? And how do you evaluate what they have or haven't done? And what that portends for the future.
So Brooks, I think the big difference between myself and Juanita and those people you've mentioned is that we are journalists and we've very much approached this book as a journalistic project. In the prologue to the book, we explain that, we have been covering the democratic state of South Africa for the past almost 30 years. Just missed the beginning few years, but we've read up a lot on that. We feel that we are ideally placed as journalists at the front line of covering the ANC's demise over the past 30 years to have written this book. So we don't come to this project as researchers like Franz, and I unfortunately weren't blessed with a crystal ball. So I don't do scenario planning. I would never give myself out as a scenario planner. What we do in the book is we report and we analyze and investigate on what we have covered and have seen. So for example, on coalition governments, we look closely at the examples we have since 2016 when Johannesburg fell into coalition hands, the city of Johannesburg in the local government election, which was really the first big, I would say, move of that momentum, of that tide against ANC one-party rule. And we've looked what happened in the past, 7 years in places like Tshwane, Nelson Mandela Bay. Of course, Cape Town, almost 15 years ago was the first city to go out of ANC rule into a coalition led by then Helen Zille, who was the mayor of Cape Town, who led a very eclectic coalition government consisting of people like Buddy Chaban, the late Buddy Chaban, and other colorful characters that she had to bring together. She was particularly good at that and managed to kind of win most of them over into the DA eventually, which is one of the criticisms now against coalition partners with the DA. But we looked at the past 30 years at the ANC's very bullish beginning. We looked at the promises of 1994, this a specific chapter where we track or we outline the ANC's about 30 promises they made in their 1994 manifesto. And we try and score them, obviously very subjectively, but we try and score them according to publicly available metrics on things like education, corruption, crime fighting. As journalists, these are things we have covered. You know, we have covered the dearth of our education system, the fact that only 19% of 10-year-olds can read for meaning 30 years after the birth of democracy. The fact that we still have almost 4,000 schools with pit latrines. So those are some of the real life examples, factual examples we bring into our adjudication. And then looking at the future, we look at the leaders of these different parties. And again, we dig into their election results. I'm an absolute, Kunita and I are both election nuts. We love analyzing elections. We love to see different paths to victory, how the ANC could stay in power. And we focus in on the main ones, Brooks, which we think are the most likely paths to power for after next year's election nationally, but also provincially, because I think we often forget to talk about the provinces when we talk about 2024. It's not only going to be about national, but there's going to be a big highlight specifically on Gauteng and KwaZulu-Natal. So that's really the approach we had to the book.
In that sense then, when I, in my notes, I said, by what metrics are you judging government failure or success? The metric seems to be an experienced journalist's, the texture that you feel about things rather than simply numbers. Or am I underestimating the quality and the?
Absolutely. I mean, so we do refer to stats and, you know, unemployment numbers and corruption numbers and crime statistics. I mean, the fact that the murder rate is back 20 years, in the past year, you know, we are now where we were 20 years ago. All the, advancements, in terms of crime fighting has practically been wiped out in the past 2-3 years. So we do refer to those statistics as objective facts, but I think we also quote people we spoke to. We quote sources inside the ANC, former ANC people, people who've left the party, you know, and we ask them, how did we get here? You know, how did we get here? How did we fail to achieve many of these lofty ideals that the ANC thought they would do, when they came to power in 1994? And, you know, we don't try to give people a answer of who will rule South Africa. There's not one answer at the end of the book. Spoiler alert. I mean, there's quite a few, but I think
I can't go to the end to find out what's going to happen.
But I think Juanita and I, the one thing we feel very passionate about, and we refer specifically to the late Alistair Sparks in our prologue, because Alistair wrote a fantastic book called Tomorrow is Another Country in 1996 that looked at the process of negotiations and the transition in South Africa, the relatively peaceful transition. And I will never be so boastful as to say we did the same book 30 years later, but we were inspired by the concept, the way that he approached that project to say, you know, let's look into the past, but also into the future. Who are the leaders? What are the polities? What are the main issues of the day that will determine our future? And that's what we've tried to do here.
We're going to take a quick break, station identification and commercials and all those useful things. This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, your host. And today's guest is Adrien Bosson, who is going to explain to us the future. He's written a new book, Who Will Govern South Africa, together with a colleague, Juanita Hunter, and we'll be right back.
This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And this is the Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, your host, and this morning's guest, Adrian Besson. Adrian is an experienced, prize-winning journalist, author of notable books, but now with a new one on the bookshelves, Who Will Govern South Africa? And he said, just before we took a break, he said, I'm not going to give you the answer as to who is going to govern, but then let's look at the various potential claimants that you have identified. And I don't like horse race politics all that much, because I think it dumbs down the question to a, you know, to an almost simple mechanistic one. But in this case, because the circumstances are so flexible or not clear, score the potential claimants a bit, pluses, minuses, possibilities, unlikelihoods.
Let's start with the ANC, Brooks. I mean, we have to. ANC is the largest party in South Africa. They've been the governing party for 30 years. And the ANC came to power in 1994 with a clear majority, but has since slipped in the past decade or so. So I think the ANC peaked in around 2004 under Thabo Mbeki as president on around 69% of the national support. And I don't know if you remember, but at the time there were serious debates about, you know, whether it's healthy in a democracy to have a party that has two thirds, which means you can alone in parliament do a lot of things on your own if you have more than 66.6% of the support in the legislature. Well, those days are long forgotten. We are now going into an election where every single poll that I've seen so far is predicting that the ANC will go below 50. So that's 20 percentage points away from 2004. That's about 20 years. That's not a pretty picture for the ANC. That is it's a horrific picture. It is a very worrisome picture for the ANC. And if you speak to people within the ANC, they know this. They know that this is possibly going to be their worst electoral outcome since 1994. They are preparing for coalition politics. The ANC over the past few months has come to the table, which is, I think, a very good and democratic development that happened. The ANC has come to the realization that they will probably, that the continuation of government in South Africa at all three levels of government is very likely going to be at coalition level. So the ANC is preparing themselves to come in around 50%, just below, just over maybe next year in 2024. I think best case scenario for them would be to get 50%. That will mean a big push from now for the next 6-7 months until we go to the ballot box. And even in the case of them getting to 50%, it's going to be a very different ANC. It's going to be a less arrogant ANC, because if a few MPs are absent or change their mind on the day, they might lose a vote in parliament. The ANC is a very different animal from the one that came to power in 1994. I think in 1994, the party was full of idealism, and the party championed principles like non-racialism, which we argue in the book they've kind of lost their way on since then. The party has very much become a nationalist, Africanist party that's often identified with corruption in the country. We have very deep entrenched crony systems in the ANC, where people are just staying in their positions to make sure they get the next tender. So I think the ANC that's going to be on the ballot next year is a different party from the one that had Nelson Mandela's face next to it 30 years ago. But the party is very likely to remain the largest party in South Africa. Whether they get 40% of the vote or 45% or 50%, they will very likely be the largest party, which means I don't expect them to be out of government completely. I expect them to be in some form of permutation that governs the country through a coalition.
Let me ask you a question. I mean, in electoral politics, and I've watched them for years in various countries, and not least of all in my own, the United States, the thing that is most important on election day is turnout as opposed to polling. Polling is not predictive. Polling is a snapshot of opinions and ideas at the time. Turnout is what matters when people either do or do not show up at the polls, let alone make choices that are A, B, or C. And I've heard it said that the lower turnout favors the ANC. The smaller the turnout, it is less likely that people who dislike the way things have gone will show up and vote for an alternative.
Well, I think if you look at the 2021 local government result, that actually challenges that perception, Brooks, because there you saw the ANC getting very poor turnout and the opposition actually keeping quite steady or even increasing their turnout. So my understanding of turnout is that, you know, the ANC has to get the electorate to vote. And you actually saw since 2016 with the local government election, you saw ANC voters staying away from the polls, not coming out to vote for a different party, but staying away. In 2021, specifically in Johannesburg, you had the rise of someone like Herman Mashaba and Action SA, which came from nowhere to 17% of the vote in the city of Johannesburg. That took away ANC votes, undisputedly, in places like Soweto and other of the townships on the west rand of Johannesburg. So I think turnout is going to be an absolutely crucial factor. I'm closely following the campaigns of the new kids on the block, like Songezo Zibi and Rais Mzansi. And what all of them are saying is that turnout is crucial. If they can get another 1 million, 2 million people to come out to vote, people who's never voted, that could fundamentally change the landscape. That is, of course, very... very optimistically, and there's also a reason for low turnout, which we explore in the book. It's quite complicated, Brooks, the reason why people don't vote. A lot of people just practically cannot vote. They cannot get to a voting station. They cannot afford to travel to a voting station. They don't have an ID book. They are not registered. So it's practical reasons. Another large group of people just don't believe in elections anymore, have given up on the democratic idea of voting, and thinks that the day one vote cannot make a difference. And these are not small numbers. I mean, if you look at amount of votes cast in the last national election, and you add to that the number of adults who are not even registered to vote, you come to about over 20 million people who do not participate in our electoral process. I mean, compare that versus the ANC's 10 million votes that they usually get in an election. So the majority of our country, of adult South Africans, are not voting, which is a major, major concern. Not only does it affect the party's percentages and prospects for success, but I think it affects the whole democratic process if you have the majority of the country not participating in something to which the black majority of the country couldn't even participate in 30 years ago. So I think turnout is going to be a key indicator in this election of where we stand in terms of the electorate's attitudes towards democracy into their country. And then absolutely turnout is going to be a key thing. You can expect to see the large parties, the ANC, the DA and the EFF specifically coming out hard over the next few months and specifically next year to campaign, to get people registered. Of course, another game changer we have this time is that people can register online to vote. So for the first time in the first national election ever that you can register online. Whether this will bring 1 million more people to the polls, we'll have to wait and see for that.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, and it's we're pleased that we're chatting with Adrien Besson, co-author of Who Will Govern South Africa? New book just out in the bookstores now, and we'll be right back.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, the host, and today's guest, Adrien Besson, veteran journalist, out with a new book co-authored, Who Will Govern South Africa, co-authored with Juanita Hunter. We were talking about the question of turnout. Now, of course, in Australia, everybody is required to vote on pain of death, but certainly it's a civil penalty if you don't, like a very nasty traffic ticket. In the United States, it's not required, but in a good presidential election, an active one that's highly contentious, you get 60-some percent of the eligible electorate actually showing up. In off-year elections, just members of Congress or some governors and state legislatures up for election, that share drops rather significantly. Of course, we could be like North Korea, where 110% of the people eligible to vote. They all vote the same way. But you were going through a list of, you were taking them, the potential claimants for leadership in governance or a coalition government. You mentioned the African National Congress, but we stopped you there, and you hadn't gone through the rest of the pack.
Yes. So in number two, we have the Democratic Alliance. So the DA is very interesting, Brooks. Lots has happened in the DA over the past two decades, from a very small opposition party under the likes of Colin Eglin, Zach De Beer. Then Tony Leon took the party, grew the party much bigger. And I think Helen Zille was the game changer leader for the DA that made the DA an acceptable party outside of white South African neighborhoods and suburbs. The DA almost peaked in 2016 when they were really in the high 20s nationally, if you put their scores together. So 2016 was a very interesting election. It was a local government election. Musi Maimane was still the leader of the DA, the first black leader of the DA. And the party did very well in that election. They managed to, if you added up their results, got to about 26-27% of the national vote, which put the DA about 7 years ago clearly on the path to 30%. So for the DA should have been a 30% party by next year. That path was there, and they only have themselves to blame. There's lots of factors. The current DA leadership will tell you that it was all Musi's fault and that he kind of lost the public sentiment and alienated traditional white Afrikaans readers by doing, sorry, electorate or voters by doing some strange things in the Northwest province before the 2019 election. The people who have left the DA will tell you that the so-called classic liberals from Helen Zille's side has taken over the DA, that there's simply no more regard for race in the party, and that the majority of senior positions in the party are now filled by white men, and that it doesn't matter, that it shouldn't matter. It's all about merit, and that these white men are the best people to have. So the DA is the soul of the DA is really was up for grabs. And it seems for the moment that it's fallen to the Zille kind of belief, you know, in classic liberalism, in remaining a strong force of opposition, in strongly opposing the ANC, and then now with John Steenhuisen as the national leader. But the party's going into the election as a strange animal, because it has also proven itself to be pretty effective in government, specifically in the Western Cape and Cape Town, where I live. The DA has really been good at government and governance. I think from objective measures, you know, not subjective, you know, lived experiences, but from objective measures, the DA governs well in the Western Cape and in Cape Town. And that is a massive benefit that the party takes to it into an election where we see basic civil service delivery failures in big cities like Johannesburg and Pretoria and Durban. Residents of these cities, as you would know and see, you know, in our reportage, now almost on a weekly basis complain of basic breakdowns in water, in infrastructure, in potholes, in roads, in traffic lights, etc. So, you know, they will very likely in people's minds be that Western Cape, Cape Town factor when they consider voting for the DA. But I do think the party has lost out on getting to that 30%, and mainly through alienating the black electorate. The DA has not done anything spectacular over the past few years to try and get more black voters, the majority of South Africans' population. And I think that will come to bite them next year. That's why we're looking at polling of around 23-25% max for the party in next year's election. So we are almost back to 2016, if not slightly worse off for the DA. But I'm pretty confident, Brooks, that they will be the second largest party. And even on 23-24%, that's still a significant power base to be able to do interesting moves when it comes to coalitions. We've heard, and something we write about in the book, is interesting permutations being discussed inside the DA. One of them is that the possibility that they become that they kind of make a deal with the ANC to take over parliament, to take charge of the legislature in return for the, or in exchange for the ANC running the executive. Now, this could be a very interesting scenario. Of course, the DA denies it on the record now, and they will not campaign on this ticket at all before the election. But what you may very well see after the election, and we might get to that in this discussion, is there's only a few options on the table, of which one of them is either an ANC-DA matchup or an ANC-EFF matchup. And then, you know, people will have to decide what's the best for South Africa's future, what's the best for stability, for our economy and for our country. And I think in that scenario, I could easily see the DA going to their voters and their leaders and saying, it's either us or the EFF. And what's the better option of the two? But of course, they are now part of this multi-party charter, with Action SA, the Inkatha Freedom Party, the ACDP, the Freedom Front Plus, and other smaller parties, and they will campaign on that ticket of an alternative, you know, an alternative government. I struggle, Brooks, to see that charter getting to 50%. I just can't make the math work. Even best case scenario for all those parties, using the best available polls and historic election data, I can't see them reaching 50 as a charter.
Switch gears and discuss everybody's favorite public figure, Julius Malema, and his party.
Yeah, Malema's got a very interesting and tough election in front of him. He actually, the EFF has dropped support between the 2019 national election and the 2021 local government election. So they went down to about 10%. From around 11. So the EFF really has something to prove in this election. They are still polling around 11 to 12% of the support. And frankly, I don't see anything that shows me that they will go over that threshold or that ceiling that they seem to have settled on, which is around 10% of the support. Very significant 10%, Brooks, because that 10% is very valuable to the ANC and to the DA, neither of which seem very keen to play with them anymore. We've seen in recent weeks ANC leaders in Gauteng really getting annoyed with the EFF and that working relationship they have in the Gauteng metros. So I expect Malema and the EFF to continue on the rhetoric we know from that party. They will continue to campaign on things like land nationalization, nationalization of the Reserve Bank, nationalization of the mines. They will continue their race rhetoric. Julius Malema is now also campaigning against the Springbok.
I was going to say that's the killer thing in some ways. That's the one that got everybody's attention.
It will be tested at the ballot box next year. At least he's going to be there on the ballot paper. So it will be tested whether that speaks to the majority of South Africans or not. I think Malema still speaks to hundreds of thousands of people who are aggrieved with the state, who have lost all faith in the ANC, who is still suffering from poor services, poor education, and a poor economy, and who simply find nothing in the DA that attracts them to vote for the DA. So I think that still remains the EFF's market. It's a pity that there's not a lot of other players in that market, that there's not other political parties specifically focusing on that part of society. But we've also seen that Malema and the EFF struggles to get their supporters to come out to vote. We know that a lot of young people support the EFF on social media, but not at the ballot box. And of course, only the ballot box counts. Twitter isn't the real world.
We have to take another quick break and we'll be right back. This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector and we're speaking with Adrian Besson about the new book that he and Juanita Hunter have issued, Who Will Govern South Africa? And we'll be back in just a minute.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive, and your host is Brooke Spector, of course, and our guest today, the veteran journalist and author of Who Will Rule South Africa, well, actually co-author, Adrian Besson. He is the editor of Media 24, among other things, long career, award-winning career, and we're talking about the probabilities and possibilities, maybe not quite the odds, but the possibilities of all the other political players besides the current governing party. And we've covered the DA and we did some things on the economic freedom fighters, but there are other players out there and there's another unusual or new process that is non-party candidates. So now I guess you get to talk about Action South Africa, Rise Mzansi, and a couple of other smaller parties. Musi Maimane's party, what does he call it, BOSA?
Built One South Africa, BOSA, yes.
And then there are people who are non-party persons who are trying to become sufficiently, they've had enough signatures to become independent candidates. Finish this off then with the parties other than the ones you've already done. Maybe start with the
So Brooks, yes, we've had about 3 years ago, a group of people went to court to challenge the constitutionality of the Elections Act. And what this was about is to say independents should be able to run in a national election. So this was this was a case was brought successfully to court, and the Constitutional Court 3 years ago already ordered Parliament to amend the Elections Act to make provision for independent candidates. This process took inordinately long, and it was not in the best interest of the ANC or other parties in Parliament, let's be honest, to pass this bill as quickly as possible, because they are creating competition for themselves. So what we have seen now is a form of the bill that's gone back to the Constitutional Court, which will probably be the one that next year's election is conducted upon, which says that independent candidates can stand in provinces to go to the National Assembly. So we've already had people like Zaki Ahmed in the Western Cape, for example, saying that he wants to run for Parliament. He will not be part of any party. His name will be on one of three ballot papers we will get next year, alongside those of political parties. And people could then vote for an individual or a party on that specific ballot paper. I think, unfortunately, there's still a lot of confusion about this in the public. I don't think the IEC has done a particularly good job of explaining this. And also, to be fair to the IEC, this process is still in court as we speak today. That is going to be interesting to see how many South Africans would rather vote for an individual, a well-known individual, in the case of someone like Zaki, or other community leaders than a party. We also have other parties next year on the ballot, which will make their debut in a national election. Top of mind is Action SA. Now, this is a party led by the former DA Johannesburg Mayor Herman Mashaba, entrepreneur Herman Mashaba from the Black Like Me fashion label. Mashaba is a very unconventional politician. He styles himself a bit on the politics of the likes of Donald Trump. You know, where he comes from business, he doesn't conform to the rules of the establishment politics. He says things as he sees it. But he has managed, I think, to his credit, to carve out a very interesting support base and niche for himself, being a black leader, an acknowledged and well-known black leader, who champions capitalist free market economic principles, champions democracy, champions the rule of law. In fact, he refers to it as law and order, and may very well surprise us in next year's election as an alternative candidate to voters who simply can no longer vote for one of the established legacy parties, mainly the ANC and the Democratic Alliance. So it'll be interesting to see how well Action SA does at the polls. The Green Machine, they're the Green Party, and they've got branches all over South Africa now, managed to get a very lively bunch of people involved with him in the party who's campaigning ground level. And I think what they're doing well is they're going down to towns, they're going into small towns and cities and starting branches and work the floor, so to speak. They're not just on Twitter. They actually get out there. Two interesting new kids on the block that we can maybe mention that we also speak about in our book is Musi Maimane, the former DA leader who started his own party called Build One South Africa, or BOSA. Maimane is still a popular politician. He's obviously got that social capital that he got through being the DA leader. He's quite vocal on social media. Whether that will translate into votes is yet to be seen. What does he bring that others don't bring? It's not clear. He hasn't really managed to get a number of other high-profile people with him. And then Songezo Zibi, the former colleague, Business Day editor and corporate communications specialist, Songezo Zibi started Rise Mzansi, which is a interesting new party on the ballot next year. Rise Mzansi seems to be well funded. They've got lots of posters up already. They've got quite a big digital footprint. And Songezo Zibi really is trying to advocate for a new style of politics. He's a young guy. He says that, you know, legacy traditional party politics in South Africa has reached its sell-by time, and he wants to offer something new. He's specifically active in Gauteng in the Eastern Cape, where he's from. And I think it's good. I think it's good that there's new faces on the ballot paper, that the menu is a bit larger than the traditional parties. Of course, the traditional parties don't like that. They don't want anyone taking away from their votes. A party like parties, specifically the ANC and the DA, would not like the idea of new parties taking the electorate. But I think it's a good development for South Africa that there are these new opportunities in the election next year. Maybe just as a final point, Brooks, I think the two elections to watch apart from the national one is Gauteng and KwaZulu-Natal. I think chances are very good that we may see coalition governments that excludes the ANC in those two provinces.
I must say, when you say a younger face, everybody in politics now, practically speaking, is younger than I am. And they're all younger faces these days.
In South Africa, but not in the United States, your country.
Yeah, no, in the United States, they're all my generation now. even the younger ones. We've talked a bit about coalition governance. You referred to it. You weren't overwhelmingly enthusiastic about the idea, but you didn't squinch up your face and give sounds of distress with the very use of the phrase. One of the things that intrigues me in this country, coalition government has a kind of negative connotation for many people, and yet it's the norm in many mature democracies. You see it all over Europe, Germany, the Netherlands, Scandinavian countries. Sometimes you see it in Canada, sometimes in Australia. You don't see it in the U.S., but within the two main parties, effectively, they are both coalitions of some fairly diverse and divergent ideas and approaches. Your view, is coalition government necessarily a problem, or is it simply that people here have yet to figure out the rules of engagement in forming one, building one, and keeping it together in a coherent way?
That's a very good question, and I think it's something we're going to have to figure out. Coalitions are here to stay, I have no doubt. There's unlikely to be another 66% party very soon in South Africa. I think the ANC is likely to just go down from here, and I think coalitions will be there to stay. I think for me, the interesting one is which permutation of coalitions, because you have to give and take. And that's the one thing I learned. I was privileged last year to go to Germany to study the coalitions permutations in Germany. And it's interesting speaking to the politicians that they are not hugely in favor of it. Of course, they can't deliver on their manifestos because they have to make trade-offs. And that will be interesting to see, you know, if an ANC-DA coalition somehow manages to come to fruition, what trade-offs are made? What does the ANC and the DA not get to do, and what do they actually agree on? Similarly, if the ANC somehow manages to sneak into the government, you know, would they be able to do some of the more radical things, or will the ANC be the big partner or the major partner in that relationship, tame them? Tell them, no, you can't nationalize, but, you know, take one or two ministries and try your best at it. So I think coalitions are here to stay. I think I'm encouraged by the fact that the ANC is part of the coalition's landscape now and is part of those discussions, because they were outside of that for a long time. The coalition space was dominated by the opposition for a long time. And it's good and it's important that the majority party is part of coalition's discussions. They often, in many countries that you've mentioned, lead the coalition, the governing coalition. And in many countries, we do see this grand coalition type formation where you have the number one and two party come together. So interesting times ahead.
Yeah, one last thing. And we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with Adrien Bosson, the author of a new book, co-author of a new book, Who Will Rule South Africa? In his day job, he's the editor of Media 24, long career in journalism. I'm Brooke Spector. This is The Deep Dive, and we'll be right back.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector. Our guest, Adrien Bosson. One last question for you. Right at the beginning of our conversation, I quoted a study that emanated from Harvard University saying, in effect, that the problems of this society were so big and so onerous, and the government's response to them so far had been so bad, so poor, so ineffectual, they could judge very little that has changed. And that, in a sense, was saying, oh, dear, politics as usual simply haven't solved the problems. And that leads you to the question, of course, and this will be our last question to you. Are the problems that face South Africa so overwhelming that politics cannot solve them, and that instead the country will inevitably turn to, a Peronista-style political circumstance, the man on the white charger, some other version of outside democratic practice? Is that the future?
I'm not there, Brooks. I think politics can solve much more than it has done. I think the right politics and the right policies could, and the right implementation of politics. I think we have great policies in South Africa, but unfortunately the execution of things like education, crime prevention is not always there. So I think this will very much be a referendum on the ANC's governance of 30 years. Some will call it misrule of 30 years next year. And there will still be a lot of people who vote for the ANC for different reasons, which we can talk about another day. But I don't believe our problems are that deep that it's not salvageable. I think with more competition, parties will be motivated to perform better and would want to show off. You can see the Gauteng premier is creating jobs every second day. I don't know if these are good jobs or sustainable jobs, but at least it's something. So there may be a new impetus as politics becomes more competitive. There may be a new impetus to actually govern, which they are paid to do in the first place.
Well, I guess we don't have any choice. We have to quote Winston Churchill right about now and say, democracy is the worst form of government of all except for all the others. And that's where you have, and that's what you have, and that's what hopefully you will continue to have. It's been a chat with Adrien Besson, editor of Media 24, co-author of Who Will Rule South Africa. I'm going to go out and pick up my copy and read it thoroughly rather than just the chapters at the beginning. And we'll hold you to it. We'll make you come back and have another conversation when we know a little bit more about what the elections are going to deliver to us. This is Brooke Spector. This has been The Deep Dive. And we will be back again next Friday at 9 o'clock for another engaging conversation with someone who can explain something important to us. Adrien, thank you very much for sharing your time with us.
Thanks for having me, Brooks. All the best.